Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. I'm your host, Marcus Gillis, and we are recording live from Banjo, Colorado. Population growing. Welcome to episode lucky number 13 of the Live from Banjo podcast. I want to start off by saying I apologize for the late hour of release to this week's episode. I took off last week for my daughter's spring break, and I've been playing catch-up since I got back. And I haven't yet. I don't know if it is age catching up, but I keep falling asleep at my computer. Rule number 76, no excuses, play like a champion. So, no excuses, and I apologize. For those of you that are new to the show, welcome, and for those returning, thank you. Please remember to follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're on Apple, please leave a review if you enjoy the show. If you have critiques, feel free to DM me at Live From Banjo Podcast on Instagram or email me directly at marcus@livefrombanjo.com. I have started a Patreon page to try and help cover the cost of producing the show. It can be accessed through the link in the bio on my Facebook page or the Live From Banjo Podcast Instagram page. I've temporarily suspended the Patreon page due to technical difficulties, but my goal is to relaunch by next week's release. In the link in my bios, you can also now stream all episodes. I've created a guest introduction page to connect you directly to our guest websites. You can connect directly to the Live From Banjo website, and I've included a link to the Live From Banjo guest mixtape playlist on Spotify. Please let me know what kind of additional content you would be interested in seeing over at Patreon. I've got some exciting content coming this summer, but in the meantime, I'd like to know how I can oblige. Today is part two of my two-part episode with Paul DeFiglia. If you've heard part one of the interview, then you may experience a little deja vu in this introduction, but Paul is a record producer and multi-instrumentalist currently located in Nashville, Tennessee. Paul was the original bass player for Langhorne Slim's band, who commonly appeared as Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles from 2004 to almost 2009. Quick house cleaning that was left out of this week's wrap-up. Located in Auburn, Alabama, Auburn University's war cry is War Eagle. It's not a mascot or a nickname. I know it's confusing because of the Auburn Tigers, but they have this thing similar to Alabama's Roll Tide or UGA's Goat Dogs. It's how you greet another Auburn fan, student, teacher, etc. Or it's how you present yourself if you're Paul DeFiglia and Malachi De Lorenzo in touring with Langhorne Slim in the second half of the first decade in the 21st century. You'll see. After Paul left Langhorne Slim and the War Eagles, he took a brief break from music. Paul started playing the bass again, and shortly after was asked to sub for Avett Brothers bassist Bob Crawford while his wife gave birth to his first son. A few months later, Paul was asked to sub again as Bob was going to miss a significant number of shows over the next year while Bob's daughter received treatment. Paul subbed as needed over the next year or so, and when Bob returned, Paul transitioned to the keys where he continued to learn and hone his skills as he traveled with the band. Paul toured with the Avetts for roughly 6 years and can be heard on the recording True Sadness produced by Rick Rubin. In this week, we deep dive into the many decisions Paul made in his life that have constantly guided him towards a life in music and to his current home at Daylight Recording Studio. Paul played bass and co-produced Langhorne Slim's newest album, Strawberry Mansion, which I think is a future Grammy winner, and also he sang, played bass, keys, produced, mixed, and released his own solo album titled In Daylight, which includes performances from Scott and Seth Avett of the Avett Brothers, Aaron Ray, Matt Davidson of Twain, Malachi De Lorenzo, and more. If you haven't done so, go back and listen to episode one and check out some clips of multiple tracks off Paul's first solo album, and then go over to Bandcamp and pick up a copy of Paul's album on digital, vinyl, or both. You'll thank me because it will make you happy and you'll really enjoy it. If this was 50 years prior, give the Live From Banjo stamp of approval, or maybe we'll go with sticker. What about NFT? Have you guys heard about NFTs? It's part of the Ether cryptocurrency, and Jack Dorsey's first ever tweet has been sold for the equivalent of $2.9 million, which said, "Just setting up my Twitter, TWTTR. I can tweet it to you for free if you like." I don't get it. That said, if you want something much more fulfilling for a lot less dollars, you can find a link to Paul's new album in the notes on my Facebook and Instagram bios and at livefrombanjo.com in the guest introduction tabs under Paul DeFiglia. In Daylight, see episode title for spelling. Also, I want to note that about 20 minutes prior to the end of the interview, Paul and I went off record, but ended up having a very true and honest conversation, and Paul was gracious enough to grant me permission to air that portion of the interview. That said, I hope the wonderful and vulnerable human beings, including Paul, that I've had on this show inspire you as much as they do me. I'm continually blown away by the honesty you receive every week. Thank you so much for everyone that is listening. Please tell your friends, family, and complete strangers about the show. And again, please follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you would like to be a sponsor, please contact me at livefrombanjo.com, email me at marcus@livefrombanjo.com, or DM. And everybody, please follow me on Instagram at livefrombanjopodcast. It really helps spread the word. Please stick around after the interview for Crystal and I's wrap-up, where we discuss childhood love for Michael Jordan, Ambusher, Ron Carter versus Robert Wadlow in the Guinness Book of World Records, indie rock, so basically all music, and please be on the lookout for some exciting news about the show coming soon. And now, everyone, please sit back and relax, unless you're doing something where that would be dangerous, and wherever you're at, please enjoy my conversation with the talented and humble to a fault, Mr. Paul DeFiglia.
I don't know. One day I just sort of looked over at the bass that had always kind of been in the corner growing up. You know, I asked my dad to like show me something on it. And then from there, I was just like, this is, you know, I didn't have to worry about the, you know, a lot of brass players. I'm going to generalize here. I'm going to probably piss someone off, but
it's fine. You can't say anything in 2021 without pissing somebody off. So we've already pissed off like at least 100 people. So it's fine. Keep going.
Well, I think it's safe to say in the trumpet world, there's a lot of thought that goes into people's range and how high, specifically how high they can play, what the highest notes are they can play. And there's some people that specialize in playing really, really, really high notes. And that was something I was really struggling with at that age. I was like in the seventh grade. So I just like
the Bee Gees of the trumpets.
Yeah, I don't know. It was like, you know, it was like a kind of a jock kind of vibe. And I was the new kid in school and I couldn't play that high on the trumpet. So I was just like, fuck this. And the bass, like, you know, to play the highest note on the bass, you just have to put your hand here and it's done. So I was like,
that was my first instrument in school. I played in the junior high orchestra. I played the bass.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I'll tell you about playing the, especially upright bass in school growing up, is that I'm sure you probably experienced this. Like you get, there's not a lot of them. They're always trying to get kids to play the bass. So you're kind of immediately like kind of good, you know, because people are just.
Oh yeah. I was definitely one of, you know, the best people in the orchestra, but my teacher was, she didn't love me and I was extremely short. So me choosing the bass, she was like, no, you should choose the cello. And I was like, no,
see,
I'm going to play the bass.
Dude, I'm telling you, music teachers, I love them, but I also like, there's so many experiences I had growing up where I had like a music teacher say something like that to me and it reverberated for, no pun intended, for my whole life. I had a band teacher when I moved schools who said, hey, maybe you shouldn't play the trumpet. Or he said something about my lips or something. And I was just like, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
well, mine kind of went sideways because I was in the South, and whether or not she was racist, my best friend at the time was black, and he also was a bass player in the orchestra, and she thought that we had too much fun, and that's probably what it was. She was just splitting up two teenage kids, but at the time, we were in orchestra together from the sixth grade through the eighth grade. And then finally the last half of the eighth grade, she was like, no, I'm splitting you guys up. So we had been in this class every, you know, cause that was the one thing you were sure of was your, you know, your orchestra group. And she split, there was two orchestra classes and she put us in opposite, both of us quit. And it kind of also made me go fuck you to the bass because there was something attached to it. And at the time I was just like, she's a racist bitch. She just doesn't want like a black kid and a white kid to be friends. Whether that was true, I have no idea, but that was how I felt at the time. And then, and so then I just started like playing my guitar all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dude, that's so funny that you mentioned that too about the height, because I'm short. I'm like 5'6".
Well, I'm 6 feet now, but at the time I was the latest bloomer. Like I was like 5'5", 5'4" until like my junior year of high school.
Well, I'm just like, I can't tell you, especially when I lived in New York, like I'd be running around on the subway with my bass and stuff. And my whole life, people have been, things bigger than you are. You know, hey, it's just like,
yeah,
you know, looking at me in like, with their jaw just like hanging on the floor as I load my bass into my car to go play the gig. It's like, yeah, you know, it's just the most like obvious, dumbest
yep.
observation one could make ever. You're just
including a music teacher.
Yeah.
Not also noticing that I, at the time, even back then, I mean, now I'm pretty much a square, but like at the time I had like a huge ape index, which I didn't know that term at the time, but like my arms like hung down to my knees. And so as a bass player, like, what do you need? You know, you don't need to be tall. You just move my arms around that thing.
No. I mean, there's great short bass players, tall bass players. I used to always think like Ron Carter, because Ron Carter's hands are like so huge. Mm-hmm. And I used to watch like footage of him playing the bass, and he's just getting around like all over the place. And he's doing like minimal movement. And I've always just been like, I could never, you know, and it's not that, you know, it's not. I mean, Ron Carter is Ron Carter because it's more than his physicality, you know, it's who he is. It's everything else, you know?
So eventually you got to this North Carolina School of Arts deal. It looks like towards the end of high school. Was that like a specialized school for, was it still part of like your regular high school education, or what was the deal with that?
Yeah. So the North Carolina, it's called the University of the North Carolina School of the Arts. Mm-hmm. But it's part of the university system of North Carolina, which includes UNC Chapel Hill and UNC Greensboro. It's an arts conservatory, and they have a high school program. So you have to audition in, and depending on what your focus is, you can go different times of your high school if you want to go. Mm-hmm. For music, I believe you can go all 4 years of high school. And for drama, when I was there, you could only go as a senior. And for visual arts, there's a two-year program. It's a great school, but it's also a college conservatory with a high school program. So it's kind of like as a high school student, it's kind of like going to college.
Very
pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I lived on campus. They have high school dorms and you have classes. So you continue your general studies to get your high school diploma, but you're also taking college level arts courses.
Yeah. That's really cool.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, the focus is on classical bass. Mm-hmm. So there was a jazz band when I was there, but there was no jazz major. When I was there, I was doing the classical thing, but with the clear kind of like, it wasn't like aiming to be a classical player, but I definitely taking, especially a lot of the music theory and ear training there, like went on to have a kind of profound impact on me later in my music career.
I can imagine. And then you went to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that you would have been in NYU from what, 2001 to 2005? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I moved up to go to NYU like basically 2 weeks before 9/11.
Oh, wow. I was up. We were probably in New York at the same time there. I was just visiting. I went to go see like a Radiohead show, and then we went up to Canada, and then I came back and we went to the World Trade Center on like the 6th or something. But then I was moving to Japan on September 11th. And so I had spent the whole night packing, and I woke up that morning and the first plane had hit. And my mom told me that my flight was going to be delayed. My sister-in-law had called and she said some plane had run into the World Trade Center. It was at that time where you're like, oh, like a prop plane, or, you know, you thought it was a private plane or whatever. And then I turned on the news and it was like minutes later when I watched the second one go through. And
yeah,
I still moved to Japan that year, but it was like 2.5 weeks later until they let us leave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Crazy time.
It was nuts. Yeah. And I was like this bright eyed 18-year-old, you know, New York City. It's like, I'd always like wanted to move to New York.
Mm-hmm.
Getting to go there and go to NYU and yeah, I mean, that also obviously had a profound impact on me. Yeah, I mean, not to be like a bummer. New York was great. Let's see. I studied jazz there. I went there with the intention of being like a jazz player primarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in the jazz program in the School of Education. At that time, they didn't have a separate music school I think now they have a music school in Tisch, the School of the Arts, or they have a music program set up that is a lot nicer than the one that was there when I went. So yeah, did that. Yeah, I think it's safe to say I got kind of disillusioned with playing jazz at my time there. Mm-hmm. And kind of ended up playing with some singer-songwriters. And the whole anti-folk thing was happening in the East Village and in the Village in general. So that was kind of interesting. And honestly, like playing like little venues, little tightly packed venues with like kids screaming and being there with my upright bass, like it was just super exciting. And mm-hmm. I got introduced to Slim.
You were friends with Malachi first, right? And
yeah, kind of. Actually, we knew of each other. Malachi loves to say that he did not like me at all. We had crossed paths a few times.
Okay.
And I had rubbed him the wrong way on more than a few occasions, being just like super drunk and loud and obnoxious.
Oh, good.
And so he was like, yeah, I don't really like that guy. And then years later, we became like best friends.
That's funny.
Yeah.
And then, so then he did that first electric love letter with Slim. And then you guys did.
With Chris Taylor from Grizzly Bear, too.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So and that was when I came in, they had just finished that.
Okay.
And we were working on When the Sun's Gone Down.
Yeah, and that was what I was going to say. So did Malachi then bring you in to do When the Sun's Gone Down? This is by words of Sean. So he said that Malachi brought you in, but he didn't know how you guys were connected.
Yeah, Malachi brought me in, I think, through Chris Taylor. Okay. Chris Taylor went to NYU.
Gotcha. Oh, that makes
Chris
sense.
Chris Taylor was also a jazz musician.
Okay.
And we had both kind of been like, you know, the cool thing about NYU at the time was that like there was a lot of experimental music happening, and there was a lot of like cross genre stuff happening. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people studying jazz there were also doing like crazy other kinds of music. It wasn't just like this kind of bebop boot camp, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. So
there was like indie music going on up there.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Lots of indie music. Yeah. That would be, I mean, there was like, it was cool. You know, there's a lot of people that were like really into these like big punk bands and stuff, but they were also coming and playing like really avant-garde, like experimental jazz. And I love that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always loved that growing up, being blown away that like somebody could be really good at both of them, or be like having one of those things inform the other.
Yeah. I'm sure that's why Scott likes Mr. Bungle, is because of that weird technical side of loud noise. You know, it's just such a interesting mm-hmm. dichotomy there.
Yeah.
So you're with Slim from basically, I don't know what, 2005 till 2008, 2009 and that time period.
Yeah. It's about like 2004. It was probably my last year or last couple of years at NYU.
Oh, that makes sense. And then the album came out in 2005.
Yeah, yeah. So about 4 years of the first time.
And then you guys toured a lot during that time. How did the mm-hmm. War Eagles name come about?
Dolph, the manager of the Avits, he introduced that somewhere. And we did not even like know what Auburn University was. We
were just
Dolph, we used to play a lot with the Avits back then. Mm-hmm. And Dolph is, you know, he's a character, and he was telling us a story one time, or telling Sean a story one time, and he was like, you know, back in the day when things were really cool, we used to use that as like, oh man, that's so War Eagle. You know, they would use that as like a term of endearment or mm-hmm. something. So we just thought that was like the coolest thing ever. And we're like, we're going to use that, War Eagle. And then years later, it's like, wait, what? Auburn University? What's that?
That's funny.
But yeah, I think we just like the way it sounded.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I assume that it was something as simple as that, but I'd never read it or seen it anywhere. So you guys toured a lot and ended up like touring around the world and doing some different things as with Langhorn. And then was it during that time, did you get tired of touring or just disenchanted with music life, or you took a break after that, right? From music a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. I just got super kind of down on all of it, really. And it was, you know, the touring was taking a lot out of me. I was also like drinking a lot and partying a lot. And yeah, I think, you know, I had some differences. I think it's safe to say like Sean and I were having some differences at times, you know. We would just both be like super messed up and then, you know,
get into it.
It was just, yeah. And then like, you know, then you have to like drive 8 hours with that person to the next gig. And it's hard,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I'm on my second marriage. So yeah, I understand. Marriages are hard.
Yeah. And poor Malachi, I had to like make the peace a lot. And, but it was also that I'd kind of reconnected with, my girlfriend, my now wife. And so there was something at home that was kind of worth like, you know, I wanted to be with her more. And I was also really disillusioned in general with the industry itself. And like what I saw at the time as being just this like really gross, sick, industry that wasn't like based on like quality of music as much as it was like kind of vanity and all this other stuff. So yeah, I kind of like in a really melodramatic fashion, I threw my hands up and I quit, you know, quit the music industry. And I had been kind of working this art handling job kind of in between tours. So I just sort of started doing that full time.
Okay. Yeah. I did this thing with film where I had a couple of bad experiences with a couple of directors and producers. Mm-hmm. And then I had that same thing where I'm like, fuck this. I'm just going to go, I'm going to move to Colorado and be done with this. And then like 10 years later, I was like, I might've been going through some other personal things at the time that I may not,
exactly.
That I may have attached exactly. to the industry that may have had nothing to do with the industry. And I just had a lot of work on myself to do, but at the time it
100%, dude. I mean, really, it's like looking back on it now, it's like, so I desperately wanted to be like a martyr and like just,
yeah,
I had such a pure heart. Like the music is so important and it still is, but it's like, man, that was a tough time. And it did not take long for me to realize that like, I couldn't just turn it off. It's not like this thing, like music is my life. It's like what I care about so much. So like going a few months without playing music, like was really hurting me. And then, but it was a really great thing for me to do because I came back to it in this way from a way of like appreciation. And I just started kind of playing a lot of, honestly, like a lot of like kind of folk and country stuff with friends and living rooms and in Brooklyn, and just like hanging out, drinking beers and doing that was the thing that kind of brought me back to the joy of the thing that I had loved and that I was missing so much.
So you met your wife then up in New York?
Yeah. Yeah.
After this period of time, you left Slim's band, you were in New York, and then you eventually though ended back up in North Carolina, right? Maybe working on your aunt's farm or something, or?
Yeah. Well, that was just, my aunt has a grass fed cattle farm in rural Southwest Virginia.
Of Virginia. Okay. And,
yeah. So we got engaged and in another spectacularly dramatic move, I was like, I want to go work on the farm for like a few months before I commit to getting married. You know, I was like this. So yeah. And I had also wanted to learn more about the farm and how it was going and how it was run. Cause actually at a certain point I had been considering going into the beef business.
Oh, okay. You know? Yeah.
It kind of was starting to make some sense to me and I was interested in it. I was like, this could be a thing. I could do this. I could try and be like this grass-fed beef guy in New York or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it would maybe, you know, it was funny because like going to the farm and working for a month was like, it was never so painfully clear that like, I didn't know what the fuck. I had no fucking business being on a farm. Like, dude, all the pieces of gear that I broke, things the farm manager had to come in behind me and like fix. He was so gracious. Brantley Ivy is his name. He's the man. But yeah, I was on the farm and it was a beautiful spring and I was like enjoying just using my hands and stuff. That's where I was. The first call from Bob came when I was at the farm.
And then this was just when his son was being born, correct? The first time they called you out there?
Yeah, and that was to sub for like 3 shows.
Okay. And then how long after that was Hallie diagnosed with a brain tumor?
I'm not sure how long it was till she was diagnosed, but...
Or how till they contacted you then?
Yeah, so basically I kind of went off, you know, those 3 shows. I was like, oh, this is going to be a great memory. And I went and got married. And then I actually went to make a record with Malachi in Milwaukee, like the day after I got married.
Okay.
And it was in Milwaukee making that record that they called me back and told me about Hallie. Yeah. So it was basically that. So I got married in late August. It was like 3 months or something. Yeah. And then I flew from making that record in Milwaukee. I think I flew to Atlanta to play the Tabernacle with them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think that was the first show I did after, yeah, back with. It's all kind of, man, it's kind of a blur.
It's a blur. What is that record that you made with Malachi? What's that called?
It was an Adam McBride Smith record.
Okay. I do know that one.
Yeah. It was his second record. It's called Traveler's Moon.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I do know the record now. I just did. I thought it was something with just you and Malachi. And I was like, I don't know about that one.
It was weird in retrospect that I even went to make the record immediately after being married. Shitty. Sorry, honey.
So, but at that same time, would that have been about the same time she was getting her show kicked off?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe there was something there. We'll blame it on that.
Yeah.
You needed keep your hands busy too.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. Her thing started off as like a blog and then ended up kind of as a video blog and just developed into what it is now.
Which is crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Emmy winning show. Nuts. So then fast forward, you go in, Hallie's situation happens, you start playing bass with the Avits, Bob's kind of coming back and forth. What was the mood like just within the band at that time with what was going on with Bob and everything? I mean, the shows, I actually saw the Avits a couple of times during that period. You know, everything seemed positive, but I know when something so traumatic is going on with your family, which, you know, that band is definitely one of those, seems like a family organization. Behind the curtain, was it more morose, or was it just kind of like out of sight, out of mind, or how was that going? Was it weird with Bob coming back and forth from time to time?
It was, the whole thing felt, I don't know. It was just, it was really scary and really tenuous seeming. Like, it was just a really uneasy kind of thing. And I don't know. I was just trying to do what was asked of me and be grateful of the opportunity to come out and do it. I didn't really know a lot of the specifics about what exactly was happening. And I mean, I knew that she had the tumor and, you know, it was, but I don't know. I mean, it's not like there was still a positivity there and a hopefulness, you know, it wasn't super dark from my perspective. Even when Bob came back, it felt hopeful and, you know, it may have been like uncomfortable at times or something, but it was inspiring too, because just, you know, to see someone like handle some shit like that in their life was inspiring. That's the only word I could think for it. Yeah. The strength that he has.
Logistically, so when he was coming back and, you know, kind of coming in and out, was he coming in for long enough periods of time that you would leave and go back home? Or was it he would come back and you would just stay on the tour? Like, I know that eventually you got to where you were playing after he came back more full time. You started picking up the piano and playing that with the band. But that initial part, how did that work with you two in the band?
I was there all the time. Yeah. Because we didn't know what was going to happen.
Right.
And if they were on the road and he had to go, like they needed somebody. Mm-hmm. It's been a while.
Our stories are so screwed up, but whatever you say out loud is perfectly fine because that's your story and that's all that matters. Right.
I mean, I do remember there being like some last minute kind of things, like especially that first New Year's Eve show. That was like a call like 2 days before, like, hey, what are you doing on New Year's Eve? You know, I just happened to be in North Carolina visiting my family for the holidays and stuff. But it was like, hey, can you come down and just kind of be there in case or whatever? I think that's what I did. I'm not sure if I even played the show. But yeah, it was just sort of good for me to be around. And that's what led me, because at a certain point, I was also, you know, I was considering like taking on another kind of capacity with the band, not even a musical one, just being like a stage tech. You know, it was like Justin was kind of like at a certain point, you know, he started showing me what he was doing with the front of house sound. And I was like, all right, maybe I could kind of take on some sort of role like that. And it organically kind of came into the keys playing because they had a keys station set up on stage already for their shows because they both play piano. Yeah. So it was already set up and ready to go. And, you know, a lot of the songs, it was just sitting there. So, you know, I think I kind of purposefully sat down at the keyboard a few times, or if there's a piano backstage, like I would sit down and play. Cause you know, I kind of like, I played a little bit in college. Like we had to take piano class, you know, I've also always enjoyed just sitting down at the piano and trying to figure something out.
Oh yeah.
Cannot play. Like I suck, you know, it's like, it's really hard. It takes me a long time to figure out how to play something on the piano. I did not grow up taking piano lessons. My fingers do not just like gracefully play. Like I have to bang into a piano for hours in order to figure out how to do something, but I enjoy it. You know, I think any musician, any Western music, you sitting down and playing the piano is something that's it's unmistakable because you can kind of do it all. You know, you can cover so much ground on a piano. You can play anything, you know, solo version of anything, and really kind of be playing the bass, be playing the harmony, be playing the melody, and it like it's all there. So it's a fun thing to do. And a few times I remember one show in particular, like there was a piano backstage, I sat down at it and I played it like all day, and I was like learning how to play some jazz standard or something, or maybe but you know, I knew what I was doing too. I was kind of like, hey, you know, like giving them a little like, hey, you know, like maybe I could play some stuff. So that led to playing a song or two like during sound checks, and that led to like, you know, on certain shows Bob would be there, they would say, why don't you play The Fall tonight, or why don't you come out and play another one of their like million songs,
something off Carpenter or somewhere in that range.
Well, actually that's funny that you mentioned that, because they had just recorded the Carpenter, and there's a lot of piano stuff and key stuff happening on that record. So that was another opportunity for me to come in, especially when that record came out, for me to come in and play those parts and fill those gaps a little bit that they did on the record.
Yeah. And it was interesting though, because you came into the band and then they finally officially kind of pull you on as you're the key player or the, you know, pianist or organist, whatever you want to call it. And then they have the Carpenter, but then they also have basically Magpie and the Dandelion like already in the can that just needs to be mixed from the same session. So you're with them for this fairly long period of time with the band like that didn't go into the studio. That's just touring all the effing time.
Yeah, I know. It was like, man, that's why when I ultimately did get to make that record that I made with them, it had been a long time coming.
It's such a good album though.
Thanks, man. I think it's great. I thought the Carpenter and Magpie were great records too. But, and I would just like happen to come in there like right, you know, after those had been done, but it was worth the wait.
Yeah. And then so in that time period, you're playing keys and then you get to record True Sadness a little bit, say after that album came out, then May It Last comes out, Doc, I would say later that year, maybe the fall of that same year that the Doc got shown at South by Southwest, you left the Avett Brothers. All I've read is that you had decided to do something different musically. Or was that that time recording True Sadness and being with Rick Rubin and deciding, you know, I like this part of the process and want to do more of it? Or was it a culmination of things? I started going to see the Avett Brothers in 2005. Mm-hmm. My tattoo artist knew the Avetts in Georgia, and he would go up to his shows. And so he would bring these like,
I know who it is you're talking about.
We're just going to leave that name out, but just due to recent issues, we're going to leave his name out. I was getting tattooed and I was just about to move to LA, and the Avetts were coming in like right as I was leaving, and I found them, you know, and then they've just been one of my, you know, probably one of my favorite bands of all time since then. So you left Langhorne Slim, who I just loved. And then you ended up in Avetts and you're like, yeah, you know, this isn't really for me. And so then I wondered, did you get to that point where you were burnt out with touring, or were you just wanting to be home with your wife? Or was it really that you just wanted to try this new next step? And how that
Well, first of all, I'll tell you, it's not the wife, because she's never home anyway. Just kidding. She is home sometimes, especially lately. But man, it's a culmination, and I feel weird being like the dude that quits the band all the time. You know,
I don't know if twice is all the time over a course.
Well, it feels like that sometimes. You know, like I'm like, shit, am I just that dude?
That happened 10 years apart. You know, I think you're okay.
Yeah. It definitely, recording that record with Rick had a profound impact on me, and recording and producing is something that I had over the years enjoyed more and more doing. Mm-hmm. So it was like, I want to be doing this more, and it was hard to do it as much as I wanted to be doing it with going out of town as much as I was going out of town with playing with the Avetts. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's probably the bigger thing was that I kind of hit a wall with my playing the keys, and just wasn't getting the, like when I first was playing it, when it first kind of was put on the table, like, hey, you could play keys with this, with us, you know, and this could be your role. Like, I really took it on as like this opportunity for kind of like, yeah, it's going to be awesome to play shows with a huge band, but it's also gonna be really awesome to like really put some time into this instrument, like learn how to play the piano a little bit, and also, and then later it became like, and learn how to play the Hammond organ, like, and get some like aware, you know, like learn about this instrument. It's fascinating from a purely musical standpoint. It's a fascinating instrument, and that was able to fuel me for a really long time. That and the fact that the Avetts are super awesome people, and their crew, and like everybody involved is just the best. Like, can't say that enough. But at a certain point, that sense of discovery, and maybe, you know, my own, just, I just kind of hit a wall with my development as a keyboardist that I just could not like ignore anymore. Mm-hmm. And I also just like, honestly, like straight up, I just really miss playing the bass. Like, I just wanted to be playing more bass. And it was a hard decision to make, man. It was a really hard decision to make, because I loved that band. I loved all those people. And kind of turning my back on the bass or whatever, you know, even that's not really what it was, but it felt that way to me. At a certain point, like, I kind of wanted to just reclaim that, if you will, you know? Wanted to like kind of fall back in love with the bass again. And like, it's just that's my first instrument. It's my first love. And it's like what I feel the most comfortable. Like, there was not a moment that I spent behind the keyboards playing with the Avetts where I didn't feel in some way like inferior or like an imposter or just super uncomfortable. I mean, dude, I'm learning how to play an instrument in front of like tens of thousands of people. It was like a really stressful thing.
Yeah. I mean, I could probably do an entire show talking to you just about that aspect of that story. That is friggin' incredible. How do you learn how to play the piano? In my mind, like, one of the biggest rock bands in the world. I mean,
well, the answer is I didn't.
Yeah, that's in your mind. But see, yeah, I've already learned that you you like yourself as much as I do, as like much as I like myself. That's what I was saying. Yeah, that, no, yeah, I like you plenty. Yeah. <Just kidding.
laughs> No, I get what you're saying completely.
But yeah, that's it. That is, it is really incredible. We have like blown through time. I could literally talk forever, but nobody will listen if I go on too long.
Yeah, it's been really good talking to you. Like I get kind of nervous about doing anything like this, and it's been really easy for me and natural. You've been, I appreciate you asking me to do it.
Well, that it means a lot to me that you appreciate that, because I try and do my job as much as I can. I started off as a journalism major before I got into film, and then kind of left that. And then after I got sober, I kind of went backwards and was like, you know what? Kind of got to go back to my first love. Mm-hmm. and my loves are music and, you know, stories.
Yeah.
And this was a way to kind of mix those two things.
Yeah. How long have you been sober?
Tomorrow will be 1 year.
Oh, tomorrow?
Tomorrow.
Wow, dude.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, let's not jinx it.
Yeah. I think I'm in the
clear.
Still
got a few more hours.
I think, but yeah, last night this year, I was sitting probably about here in this room. My wife got home. It was like 7 o'clock, and I had been drunk for most of the last 6 weeks, and I was here at 7 o'clock, and I had no idea how I'd gotten here. I'd been going through a lot of stuff, and if you ever listen to this show, you'll find out some of that shit, but like I'd been going through some personal things and dealing with some childhood trauma and stuff, and just wasn't dealing with it well anymore at 40. it's kind of spiraled out of control. And I told my wife, I was like, I gotta pretty much stop this now, or I'm going to be dead or in jail, or I'm going to lose you and my daughter. If I don't stop now, I'm going to lose everything. And it's been, I won't lie, it's fucking been difficult because I've used drugs and alcohol. I quit drugs like 12 years ago, but then the alcohol continued to pick up its pace and got away from the arts. And so then it was just work. And then once it work got to where it's just fucking terrible. So, and see.
Yeah. Well, dude, I mean, there's so much I could talk about. Like getting the call, playing with the Avits, you know, that was like the thing that made me start really having to, I mean, I've always been like a blackout drinker.
Yeah, me too.
But that was the thing that really made me start having to hide it, because most other bands, it's just sort of like par for the course, right? But the Avits kind of were like, they knew too, because I had been coming around with Sean, like they knew I liked to get down.
Right.
And they let me know early on, like, if you fuck up, like you're out of here, you know? So I just had to start hiding it. And that was a whole new dimension for me. And so I ended up getting sober within that first year of like playing with them, and been 8 years for me.
Oh, you are sober.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I did not know that. When you asked me about it, when we talked on the phone and you asked me about it, is this show about this? And I was like, no. And you're like, okay. Yeah.
I didn't want to play my hand, you know?
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah.
So, tomorrow's 1 year.
Dude.
Yeah.
That's huge.
Yeah. And hopefully, and honestly, you know, this is especially during the pandemic and as it drew on, you know, this is kind of, it's kind of like going to meetings, having this and having this and it, even putting it out there into the world, you know, part of who I am is being sober, is that, you know, that little voice in the back of your head that says, you know, you're not just letting yourself down if you do this, you know, like having that kind of accountability on such a grand scale, I think makes it easier. And so I'm really hoping to continue this on, because it's been so much, it's brought me so much joy in such a short period of time.
It's amazing, man. It's also really cool that you can make that realization, make that connection back to journalism, and like, that's so important, man. You know, and that's one of the gifts of sobriety, is that get to like have that kind of clarity.
Cleaning out your closet and clarity, you know, like two things that, who knew, you know, like I said, I mean, I'm not perfect, you know, like I have my days where I'm just like, I don't know what to do. I only know how to fix my problems with this one thing. Yeah. But but I'm getting better at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Dude, I can't tell you how, like, playing with the Avits for me, the thought was always in the center of my mind, like, this is the biggest opportunity you've ever been given, and you're going to fucking get wasted one night and you're going to lose it. Mm-hmm. And then what are you going to do for the rest of your life? So, like, it came around to this thing where I was able to actually, like, get away from some of that fear of, like, losing the gig and be able to say, like, you know what, I'm good enough. I'm, like, I'm capable of, like, I don't have to do this gig to be happy. You know what I mean? Like, it's, I don't know. I could talk for ages about this. I don't want to, like, take up too much of your time.
Oh, and you can, it's funny. Sometimes I've gotten done with interviews and talked to people for an hour, like after what the recorded part of the interview, you know, just in different stuff. And sometimes stuff people don't want on, you know, like one recorded, yeah. And they're like, oh, I don't want to talk about this, but this is my personal experience.
Yeah.
But yeah. Well, it sounds like you're going to be producing a lot of music, and hopefully we'll stay in touch. And I'm hoping to come out to Nashville here later in the summer. If everything goes in the right direction with COVID, I'm going to hopefully go see the Lone Bellow in August. So,
oh, cool.
And so hopefully while I'm out there, I can do some traveling interviews. Assuming COVID's starting to make its way in the right direction. Killer. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have one question that I ask. I have, like, my trite finish the interview question. And it was funny because you have Nature Boy, the Nat King Cole. And, do you know the, artist Lindsay Lou? She was with Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies. They're Nashville, or she's Nashville now. She's from Michigan, but they're kind of a folky. She's more folk.
I know the name. Soul. I know I've heard the name.
Yeah. If you looked her up, she's a really phenomenal singer, but, I asked her that at the end, and she sang me, like, the last few lines of Nature Boy was her, like, her way to finish this. But my question is, like, is there anything that we didn't discuss that you want to promote or put out there? Or is there any words or advice you want to say to the world before we go? Any words of advice to the world? Any bumper stickers?
Advice? I mean, it's like, I like chafe at anything, like, cliche or corny to a fault, but it's like, it's all out there, you know, and
life's cliche.
I know it is, man. I mean,
that's why bumper stickers are so relevant. It's because a lot of time you're like, yep.
Yeah. Well, here's a good one. I just lost a good friend last week. And I've never lost a friend this close to me. His name was Jerry. And he was, for a while, he was a tour manager for Dawes. You may have heard about his passing, but he's actually another brother in sobriety as well. He had 32 years, and he was a really wise dude. And I can't believe that I can't, like, you know, tell him, like, call him up right after this interview and tell him, you know, what's going on, blah, blah. So just tell people you love them and don't wait. Don't hesitate. Just tell them you love them as often as possible. This past year, if anything has become more clear to me, it's you have to do that, because all the death that we've experienced as a world, you know, it's just like, it's just not, you don't know, there's no givens, you know, and that's like such a cliche thing, you know, but it's so true, man, because I talked to Jerry a week ago, exactly, you know, and now he's gone. I told him I loved him when we got off the phone, but I could have told him that more. And so there's always people to tell, you know, that we're not telling. So
yeah,
that's all I got. It's just
spreading love to the world is such an important thing. And then letting the people you know around you that you love them. Cause like you say, you never know.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good point to end on, but we'll be in touch and really appreciate you coming on and being open and letting me in on that bit of information that I was unaware of, and your sneakiness on the phone the other day. Man, you had me fooled. I was like, God, he doesn't want to come on the show because I'm like of this like fear of it being some kind of weird sobriety like cult.
Well, no, I honestly have a thing. It's kind of dumb, but I've always been a little like guarded about my promoting my being sober in the public arena, you know, and some people are a lot more comfortable doing it than others. And I just felt like, to me, for a long time, it was a really personal thing that just like,
it is,
didn't want to say anything about. It's only been in the past couple of years that I've been able to come around and see really buy and accept that my experience can help others. And like, that's a huge hurdle to get across. And now I feel like, you know, if I pick up a 9-year coin, like I'm going to put this shit on Instagram. Cause you know, it's like,
yeah,
I'm fucking proud of it. And I've heard directly from people that are like, whoa, that really is cool to see that you're doing this thing too. And
literally that's what the show is about, is just people being able to put out like whatever their experience is, because people like you, you know, people like Slim, had Brian Elmquist on recently, and you know, just a lot of other great people that are just, you know, they've had experiences. And whether for like, for me, you know, I was molested as a child, and like me putting that out there, there's people like, I went 30 something years without being able to tell anybody because I didn't hear it. And one day I heard somebody that I respected say it, and I was like, oh, you know, I just like, it would have never, like, it was like this little, you know, it's that deep, dark thing that you're hiding. And then it's like, oh, you said that. And then like, once I started to say it and then I became more comfortable, it was all of a sudden, it was like, oh, you know, like life is a little bit better now that I've gotten it out there. And one of the things I want to be able to do with this show or help to is to grow up big enough to where, you know, maybe I can make some difference with some of the people that come on and be able to share their experiences and be open about, yeah, we're all fucked up and going through crazy shit, and the world's strange, but you know,
it's empowerment.
Yeah.
So yeah. And it takes the shame. It sucks the putting light on stuff. It just, it's amazing. Right.
It is. Just it is important. About it. Well, man, I really appreciate it. Thanks again.
Yeah. Thank you. Let me know if you end up coming to Nashville.
I will, man.
And we'll get together. You know, anytime, yeah, you know, let's chat again. It's just fun.
All right, brother. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks.
All right. Bye. Sounds good. Thanks, Marcus.
And that's the level that you're...
Do you want me to push it even closer to my face?
Yeah, that'd be good.
Do you want me to lick it while I'm at it?
Yep.
No, I'm not doing it.
To your microphone.
Yeah, I know. I just don't want to lick it. I already told you it smells plasticky, and I don't think it'll taste good. And I'm also mildly afraid that I'll be electrocuted.
Let's see what happens.
No, I really don't want to.
Okay, I won't push you into it because that's the appropriate thing not to do. So I don't have a song to start off the day with.
What the hell, man?
Well, I thought maybe because this is a part two.
Okay.
That maybe the wrap up doesn't need a song.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm just drawing a blank. Nothing's coming to me. I don't feel the fever. Do you have something?
No, I had no idea I would be put on the spot like this.
You got to be prepared.
No, I will not.
Rule number 76. No excuses. Play like a champion.
I refuse to. I tried for a couple of episodes to come prepared to these, and I didn't enjoy that process at all. So... I think I've decided I'm stopping that.
We just got back from spring break.
Yeah.
Spring break. Panama City Beach.
No, we did. We still did not go to Panama City Beach.
No. Okay.
It was a bit of a lamer spring break. It was kind of. We got chased down by snow at every turn.
At every turn.
We spent a lot of time in hotel rooms watching Netflix.
Did we watch that much? I guess you guys made it through pretty much
we did.
The entirety
all
of
three
four,
seasons.
Four seasons.
All four seasons?
Of The Good Place.
The Good Place. And one episode of Drunk History, which happened to be the drunk history that took place in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. So it seemed relevant and cool at the time.
I think I was busy that night.
That was the night that you spent all night prepping last week's episode.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It happened.
I recorded the
intro from a coat closet
at like, I don't know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
You never came to bed.
I came to bed.
You didn't. No.
I did the next day.
After breakfast at 11.
Yeah. But we saw a bunch of cool art in Santa Fe.
We did. Everything is art in Santa Fe.
True.
The bathroom at the restaurant, the last place we went, was full of art. The hotel was full of art.
Yeah, the hotel has my favorite piece of art. Yeah, Santa Fe has a lot of art.
We went to Meowwolf.
I recommend that.
Yeah, it was cool.
It was cool.
Yeah.
I'm excited about the one in Denver because the one down there was like, what are we doing? And then they just kind of came up with it. And this one, they've had years to kind of think on it.
So the Denver one is supposed to open in 22, you said?
Yeah, I thought it was supposed to open in 21. And then I saw something that said they weren't going to open until 22, but then something posted the other day. So I'm not sure. Either this year or next year.
Cool.
So a little follow-up to last week's wrap-up, because we were short on time. I wanted to hit Paul and I's Chicago connection real quick. WGN is a Chicago weather sports news station. It was like an independent television station that I guess is licensed to Chicago. I'm not sure why we had it in both North Carolina and Georgia, but we did. And I had no idea until I was older that it had been such a blessing because I never had to miss a Bulls game because I had Chicago's local channel. And my best friend in the fourth grade, Carlos Mendoza, was from Chicago. And so it worked out really well because I liked the Bulls and he was from Chicago. And so we became
He a White Sox or a Cubs fan?
I don't recall, actually, on the baseball side. Back in the day, we just had our Bulls hats. We would give each other Bulls hats for birthdays.
Cute.
Yeah. But Jordan was a Tar Heel, so North Carolina makes a little bit more sense than Georgia. But so I love the Bulls. I was a Bulls fan. As long as the Bulls weren't playing the Rockets, I was a Rockets fan.
Houston Rockets. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then, so Michael played on the Bulls from 1984 to 1993. I moved to Georgia in 87. I was already kind of a Bulls fan just because Michael's the coolest. And then that was when my Bulls love picked up and I started wearing like Bulls t-shirts and hats and whatnot. I watched a lot of basketball back then. It was probably like my most watched sport. And then in 93, Michael left basketball to go try baseball.
In 93 that happened?
Uh-huh.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And so then in 94 and 95, the Rockets won back-to-back world championships.
Oh, well, that worked out really well for you.
It was fine because...
Just a seamless transition.
Yeah. So I had my favorite player was Michael Jordan. My second favorite player was Hakeem Olajuwon.
Then, that's funny. I think I just realized from our childhood, I only know basketball players' names from one team. Wait, hold on. Magic Johnson. From two teams, can I name basketball players from our childhood?
Is it Larry Bird and Magic Johnson?
Oh, no, I was going to say, I guess Larry Bird, he was, I wouldn't even say on the radar, but like
you
your Scottie
Cheers?
No, because that was past the 9 o'clock hour.
Oh, I thought you were a Cheers person.
No, like I've seen it, but very strict bedtime rules when you have four children because they're chaotic assholes and you need to put them to sleep.
There was always a thing between the two towns that Woody and Larry Bird were from. They were both from like Indiana, but the other town was the worst town. And so whenever Larry Bird would come into the bar at Cheers, it would always be this thing and Woody would get his feathers ruffled.
No, I don't remember that storyline at all.
Okay. It was kind of a come and go throughout the history of the show. So anyway, the Red Sea's part. And while Michael is gone, the Rockets win two championships. Michael comes back. The Rockets get beat out, not by the Bulls in the playoffs the first year back. And the Bulls win the next 3 years until Michael retires again.
Sports stuff.
I meant to start this with sports stuff just so that you could just check out.
Just so I can say sports stuff and completely take a nap. Yeah, I can't pretend to snore into a microphone.
98 was my end. I went off to college. The Bulls won one last time that summer before I went to college. And then that was the end of my watching basketball. Okay, we're done with that.
Hi, did I miss anything?
No.
Okay, good.
Paul said that when he played the trumpet, his embouchure was not good enough. I kind of knew it had something to do with the way you pursed your lips onto a trumpet, or that's what I thought. But I wanted to look it up because I thought, I think I know some about music. And when he says embouchure, I'm not sure what embouchure is.
I played a brass instrument. And
you should have known what embouchure is.
I don't know what the hell that is.
So it is the way in which a player applies the mouth to the mouthpiece of a brass or wind instrument. If you're looking at the archaic definition, it's the mouth of a river belly. But that shit's archaic.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Okay. He said he was all state or something. He kind of quickly went through that, but I tried to look up old newspapers and see if I could find anything, but I couldn't.
Because you are truly the very best of all stalkers.
Yeah. So Ron Carter.
I guess it's called research when you're doing it, but.
Yeah, it's called research. Ron Carter, very famous jazz bassist. He talked about
father
his
hands. Father of Nick Carter.
Ron Carter he's one of the most famous jazz bassists.
Oh, okay.
And he was talking about his hands and how he had these.
Oh, yeah. This was the guy with the long fingers.
Yeah. I couldn't find anything that said the specific length of his hands.
Mm-hmm.
But Ron Carter is 6'4" tall. 6'4".
Everybody, that is a very tall man.
So he's in the Guinness Book of Records, and that is because he was the tallest man. No, I think that was Robert. Is it Robert Wadlow?
I have no idea. That is a weird piece of information to just have floating around the top of your mind.
The tallest man ever alive?
How is that a normal thing to just like put in the bank?
I don't know. I got the Guinness Book of World Records most Christmases. That was one of the things I asked for. But Ron Carter is 6'4" tall. This is the last number I found. Could have changed since then because he's still alive.
Okay.
And he's still playing at like 84 years old.
Lordy. All right.
Yeah. But he's been on 2,221 recording sessions, making him the most recorded jazz bassist in history.
Wow.
And put him in the Guinness Book of World Records next to tallest man on earth.
Which you will clearly memorize every line and page of.
I don't anymore, but do you remember the picture with the girl with the fingernails?
Yes,
I
do.
And then the hair. Do you remember the girl standing on the second floor? She had the hair that came all the way down to the first floor. She was standing on the balcony.
Don't remember that, but as a hairstylist, that kind of creeps my shit out.
He was also a cellist. But anyway, that was Ron Carter. And so we were talking about jazz, and I can hear something and immediately know what jazz is. But I was thinking about it. What is the definition of jazz?
What are the defining characteristics of jazz music?
Right. I mean, I hear stuff and I'm like, oh, that's kind of like a jazz inspired drum beat, or oh, this got this bass line. That's definitely like, let's look up a definition.
Isn't it partly the number at the beginning of the
time signature?
Yeah, the time signature. Doesn't have something to do with the time signature?
The time signature can play a part. Jazz is a type of music of Black American origin characterized by improvisation, syncopation, and usually a regular or forceful rhythm. Emerging at the beginning of the 20th century, brass and woodwind instruments and piano are particularly associated with jazz, although guitar and occasionally violin are also used. Styles include Dixieland, swing, bebop, and free jazz. But that noise that you made right there, that may not be able to be cut out when you're drinking your water, it really sounded like a fart.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't think it's coming out. So everybody,
it was just me.
My wife
water.
Does fart.
I do not. No, that's not
she
a thing.
But she didn't fart that time.
That was definitely me drinking water.
That was definitely her drinking water. Paul talked about moving to New York a couple weeks before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That was September 11th, 2001, where the planes hit the World Trade Center.
And you said he moved there 2 weeks before?
Mm-hmm.
All three of us were in New York at the same time.
That is so strange.
Isn't it a little bit?
It is.
Yeah. The one and only time I've been to New York is approximately 2 weeks before 9/11.
I don't know if I have it, but I mean, it's not that creepy and not that weird, but it was a little weird. We took a ton of pictures up on top of the World Trade Center.
Mm-hmm.
The whole roll of film did not produce, except there was one picture of me with Laura and one picture of Bill with Meredith. And the rest of the film was ruined. It did not come out. We did get two pictures of it. So I have a picture of myself on top of the World Trade Center on September 6th.
Wow.
But anyway, now I think just having people that have been in New York, we've had 9/11 come up a couple of episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking back to our terrible memories and then the Malcolm Gladwell thing about it. And I was just wondering how long between the two crashes. And I know in my case what the scenario was. Like, I remember my mom was in her office.
Right.
And she says, oh, your plane may be delayed because a plane just ran into the World Trade Center. Or that's what your sister-in-law just said. So I got up, turned on the news. Mm-hmm. And that's when you started seeing the other plane in the background and that was like flying. You're like, what? What's going? Is this from earlier? You know, you're trying, like, I was trying to get my bearings of like, I don't get it. And then you see the second one hit. But I talked to so many people that were like, oh yeah, I turned it on right before the second one hit. And some people it's like right away.
Yeah.
Feel like it was quite a while. And so I was like, how long was it between the two hitting? So the first flight 11 crashed into the North Tower at 8:46:40, and the flight 175 crashed into the South Tower at 9:02.
About 15 minutes?
Yeah, a little over. So, I mean, it was long enough that could have been a common event, but probably less than people just remembering the video of the second one and seeing that video of it coming behind the news broadcasters.
Right.
I would guess, but I don't know. My case, as far as I know, I have not made this up because I remember being there, but our memories are terrible.
Yeah.
So, New York, he talked about how it was kind of cool at the time when he was going to NYC and the anti-folk movement was kind of getting big, and it kind of connected in with that whole jazz integration and, you know, mixing together different styles. But I was just going to do a quick little blurb on anti-folk. So anti-folk was introduced by artists who were unable to obtain gigs at established folk venues in Greenwich Village, such as Folk City and the Speakeasy. In the mid-1980s, singer-songwriter Locke, L-A-C-H.
Okay, like the Loch Ness Monster.
But that's L-O-C.
Uh-uh. It's L-O-C-H. Yeah.
Okay, well, don't I look stupid?
Well, so, this is actually great because this is one of those only times where I have a random piece of information floating around in the back of my brain.
But I've been there. I've been to the Great Loch.
Really?
Yeah.
No, of course you have.
We live fairly close to there. So in the mid-1980s, singer-songwriter Locke started the Fort, an after-hours club on NYC's Rivington Street in the Lower East Side. The Fort's opening coincided with the New York Folk Festival. Because of this, Locke dubbed his event the New York Anti-Folk Festival. There's a bunch of people in this other early proponents list. I'm going to name two. One was Paleface and one was Beck. And I don't know if you recall, and I don't know if Paul mentioned it. I believe he did, maybe as well. But when Langhorne played with the Avets, and Sean was trying to tell me how Cracker Farm had come into the mix through Nicole Atkins.
Yeah.
So it was Nicole Atkins and Paleface, Avett Brothers, and Langhorne Slim.
Okay.
And the War Eagles. They all played in this little like crappy like restaurant venue one night. But Paleface.
Is somebody going to get really offended that you just called it a crappy eating establishment?
Possibly. I don't know the name of it. It may be a wonderful eating establishment. It did not sound like it had the best. I guess it wasn't the greatest live venue establishment as far as stage and things like that.
Okay. But they had excellent cheddar cheese balls.
Don't know. I felt like it was a Chinese restaurant, but now I'm just making stuff up. But could have been cheddar cheese balls that were delicious. They're still open. Don't go order cheddar cheese balls because we have no idea. And then the other was Beck, and Beck came up quite a bit.
Yeah.
You can go check the last wrap up. We talked about Beck a bit.
We got really in depth on how to spell his name.
It was originally B-E-K. And then after his
Beek.
Beck. And so anyway, we were talking about anti-folk and like using jazz and infusing it with things that don't necessarily make sense. He had said that Scott Avett was a big Mike Patton fan.
Right.
I said Mike Patton, who was more notably, I guess, mainstream known for his time with Faith No More, was actually originally with this band called Mr. Bungle, who he's played with after that. And they do have a lot of like experimental music, which is a mix of heavy metal, avant-garde jazz, ska, disco, funk. It gets weird.
Yeah.
But the one album that I just loved was California. It came out in 1999. It is bizarre at points, but man, it's definitely their most mainstream. And I would just guess that it was Mike Patton's least favorite of the albums just because of that. But I'm going to try and get Mike Patton on. And then I started thinking about Mars Volta. And they kind of do that blurring the lines of like punk and jazz and weird electronic noises. But there's this a little bit more cohesive. And that's Cedric and Omar from At the Drive-In. When At the Drive-In broke up, half the band went to the Mars Volta. And basically the three other members went to Sparta, just so you knew.
Thank you. I appreciate all of that.
Indie music.
These are all of my favorite genres.
We kind of joked around about like everything's indie music. And so I found, like, I think this was Wikipedia even. I try and stay away when I can, but this was kind of a good little quick blurb. Indie rock is a genre of rock music that originated in the United States and the United Kingdom in the 1970s. Originally used to describe independent record labels, the term became associated with the music they produce and was initially used interchangeably with alternative rock or guitar pop rock. In the 1980s, the use of the term indie or indie pop started to shift from its... That sounded like I said shit.
It did, yeah.
Okay. Started to shift from its reference to recording companies to describe the style of music produced on punk and post-punk labels. During the 1990s, grunge and punk revival bands in the US and Britpop bands in the UK broke into the mainstream, and the term alternative lost its original counterculture meaning. So I remember when that happened, when like it was alternative music, and then all of a sudden they were playing alternative music on the radio, and then it's like...
Well, that doesn't feel very alternative.
Yeah. So the term indie rock became associated with the bands and genres that remained dedicated to their independent status. And then so what happened is eventually a bunch of bands started trying to be stripped down as much as possible to give it more of an indie sound. And then that got popular. And it's a never-ending battle. And so that's why I thought it was interesting when the Butthole Surfers said, I hope that Beck is the new punk, because punk had started to become mainstream. And like, so there was pop punk, but then there was the old punk and hardcore punk. And
your daughter got a real kick out of that band's name.
The Butthole Surfers.
Yeah, she really was uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, it sounds a little dodgy, but I mean,
it's an uncomfortable name.
But they started in the 80s, you know?
Okay. I
mean, and they were trying to be
clearly
alternative.
They did a great job.
Yeah. And then they got signed, and John Paul Jones ended up producing one of their albums, Full Circle. Now indie can include garage rock, surf rock, rockabilly, blues, country, swing. I mean, literally everything. You could be like, oh yeah, that's really indie. And it's more about like this feeling of like what it sounds like.
It refers to almost nothing.
Yes. So it's an indie band.
Yeah.
That was our joke. House cleaning from last week's wrap up. Paul's wife, Michaela, host of Bare Feet with Michaela Malozzi. So, Paul.
It is really hard for me not to do the Ricola thing when you say it like that.
Ricola.
Yeah. There, good. You sang to me in our episode.
Oh, God. I got the
awesome.
But I don't know why, because he wrote it out phonetically for me. It's spelled M I C K E L A.
Okay.
And for, he wrote it M-E-E, lowercase, capital K-E-L-L dash U-H, Michaela.
Okay.
And it makes me want to say it with an Eastern European accent rather than Italian. I want to go Michaela. Michaela.
No, I was going to say Gru from Despicable Me, his accent.
When the moon hits your eye, like. That's amore.
Moving on.
Justin Glanville is the front of the house engineer for the Avits. And he's talked about, he said, you know, I was working with Justin a lot and I was thinking about, okay, maybe I could do something with this. And the front of the house engineer is just the person that works the mixing boards and basically tries to make what you're seeing on the stage sound like it does as it comes into the audience. So he works a lot, picks all the different mics, mic placements. That's what Justin does. So he had said he had thought about, you know, doing that. But I just wanted to give a shout out to Justin Glanville because he does badass stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Paul and I talked about, he was playing with them when The Carpenter came out. So he was going from kind of bass and transitioning into piano, and The Carpenter had kind of some piano heavy songs. Well, when they were recording The Carpenter with Rick Rubin, we said this, but just to clarify, all of the songs at The Magpie and The Dandelion were all recorded at that same time as The Carpenter.
Oh, and then they just split off the record?
You know, like, and then we talked to recently, we were talking to Kaneen.
Yeah.
Or I was talking to Kaneen about that, and she was like, yeah, basically the ones that we're doing from The Half Moon Light were just stuff that didn't make the cut. And then Langhorne was saying,
yeah,
he did Lost at Lost Volume 2. He was like, basically, Last at Lost Volume 2 was originally supposed to be just stuff that didn't make the cut. So sounds
this
like...
This is a common practice.
It is, but it sounded like more like they were certain. So they just recorded gobs of material. It looked like they were like, okay, that's an album and we have enough songs to put out another album. So they didn't go back into the recording studio for years. And then they finally went back into the studio for True Sadness. So Paul was with them for like 6 years or thereabouts.
Oh, wow. And they were just touring their butts off during that time, weren't they?
Yeah, and then they put out two records during that time.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so he finally got in there with True Sadness. Rick Rubin produced that as well. It was nominated for 2 Grammys, one for Best Americana Album and one for Best Roots Song, I think. During that album, when they were recording that, that was when the Ava Brothers doc was being put together by Judd Apatow and Michael Benfiglio. So that's why Paul's on that documentary as well.
Gotcha.
Paul is credited on a number of songs on that album as a multi-instrumentalist, including the Hammond B3 organ, piano, Wurlitzer, upright bass, percussion, background vocals. The Hammond B3 ended up being like his kind of main thing that he was known for, the Avits, especially in the live shows. He kind of talked about it as gave him, you know, some more confidence because it was kind of unique. It gave him a lot of options with, you know, being able to change things in the sound. I cannot imagine learning an instrument in front of thousands of people.
No, I don't even like playing my mandolin in front of you.
Right.
Like, won't do it.
Right. And he was just like going for it. And it's so interesting to hear that he, you know, he is somebody like us in the fact that he never thinks it's good enough. You know, he's always downplaying it, but the entire time he was playing that instrument, he never felt at home really. And didn't feel at the level of playing that other
people did. I was thinking about this as he was talking, because it is just like such a normal human emotion to have that imposter syndrome. And obviously people who are incredibly talented are not immune to this feeling. Mm-hmm. Take our version of that emotion and magnetize. What is the word I'm looking for?
Magnify?
Magnify. Wow. Magnify that by how many thousands of people are sitting in the audience at that moment. Like the extreme anxiety that feeling must cause. It's not just you're learning a new instrument, but even if you were impeccable at it, just having that imposter syndrome or like that feeling in front of just hundreds, thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
As I was envisioning it, kind of got me a little shook up.
It's uncomfortable to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also a little comforting to know that people who are incredibly talented do definitely have those emotions that us normies have.
I was going to say inspiring.
Okay.
Because, you know, somebody could go out and do that, you know, and yeah, he had all the different backgrounds and studying jazz and he had played piano in college and a bit, but to go out and play on stage.
And overcome it each day you walk out onto the stage.
Pretty impressive. And the last thing about Paul that I really did not know going in was that he was sober.
Yeah. That was quite a shocking moment for you, wasn't it?
It was, because Paul and I had talked on the phone and he kind of interviewed me a little bit on the show. And, you know, I think, you know, just making sure he wasn't getting himself into something he didn't want to do.
Which is fair.
But the main thing that I was concerned about was that he asked these questions in a specific way that made me feel like he was uncomfortable with the show being about sobriety. And yeah, I mean, we talked for quite a long time, and the fact that we have 2 episodes worth, and probably could have talked for 2 hours more if I literally didn't have to go finally, which was disappointing. But
yeah, you got that, or that came out in like the last 10 minutes of you guys' conversation. Yeah,
maybe
didn't
10
it?
Or 15 or 20, but it was still like,
and it did sound like he probably could have talked for a long time about it.
Yeah, so I think that's all I have for Ball. I'm trying to think what else. Oh, I got my first shot of
you did
COVID today. That's the first shot I've taken in over a year.
Was it?
Not, I don't know.
Well, okay.
I was making an alcohol reference.
Yeah, you were. I didn't get it because I've been living in fear.
Shots.
No.
Shots.
I don't even like it when you sing that in reference to shots.
Alcohol or?
Needles. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that was supposed to be my appointment and I chickened out at the last minute.
Turn down for what?
No, you don't have to do that. No, you're fine if you don't do that.
Yeah. Walter slept like a good boy tonight.
He did a great job.
Walter, you're doing a great job.
He knows his role.
He's getting better.
He's getting so much better.
All right. Well, I think that's all I got.
All right. Great job.
Great. Love you.
Love you.
And just remember, kid, we're all in this together.